Santa Cruz before going on to Princeton for his PhD, working in the Boric Zeno experiment. And now for the past 2.5 years or so, he's been at Stanford working with the EXO Enriched Xenon Observatory double beta decay experiment, which is what he will tell us about now. So
thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks to everyone for coming.
So what I will be talking about today is neutrinoless double beta decay, essentially. And in that context, I will spend some time on what EXO is and the concept it's trying to exploit for a successful detection of such a decay. Then I will talk about a prototype, as we call it, a detector that we are building, EXO 200, which is a smaller size. Is smaller from the size we hope to achieve, which is ultimately probably a ton-sized detector, but it's still a sizable detector in the field. And then, of course, I will have to talk about the identification of the barium ion, which is the daughter of the decay of xenon-136, the double beta decay. So double beta decay in EXO. Double beta decay is a decay of a nucleus that emits two electrons. Now, there is a standard form of the decay where two neutrinos are also emitted. And there's a lot of reasons to hope or believe, depending on who you talk to, that there is a decay where these two neutrinos are not emitted. And then you have just the emission of two electrons. In EXO, this translates into xenon-136, decaying into barium-136, plus in this case. And two electrons and two neutrinos. The whole idea of EXO is to detect the electrons, as other experiments do, but then to positively identify the barium daughter in order to make sure that the decays that you've observed with the electrons are actually double beta decays of xenon-136. This is important because all of these detectors, due to the lifetime of this decay, which is enormous, are affected by just very few events of radioactive contamination in the detector. And so finding the daughter product would be a signature of this decay having happened. So double beta decay is a rare decay, second order decay, of nuclei which are even, in which the single beta decay is not allowed energetically. This is the only hope one has to actually see this decay. If one also had the beta decay to season in this case, it would completely swamp the signal. So the standard channel for the decay I mentioned before is schematically shown here, two electrons and neutrinos emitted from the xenon. The neutrino free or less process, on the other hand, is an exchange of a neutrino, which is a virtual one. And in order for this process to happen, as I'll explain, the neutrino has to have a mass, and it has to be its own antiparticle. This is a process that violates the lepton content of the reaction from initial to final state. So the observable for EXO, and actually even for other experiments, is the energy of the two electrons. To be specific, some experiments separate the two electrons. EXO does not, and so the first thing one does is to take an energy spectrum of the energy of the two electrons together. Now, in the neutrinoless case, all the energy is carried away by the electrons. Hence, if you detect the energy of the electrons, you should see a peak at the endpoint. Here I show schematically what one is looking for. There's a two-neutron channel, which is a continuum of energy, and a little blip at the endpoint, which here is scaled to 1 for convenience. If the profile of these peaks is Gaussian, of the peak is normal, the leakage of two neutrino events into the endpoint peak, of course, is a background for the measurement, and it goes like 5.8 power of sigma. So it's very important to try and squeeze
that peak as much as possible. So some experiments exploit that alone as a tool. EXO tries to optimize the detector in order to achieve the best possible sigma of the detector. A step back on neutrino S double beta decay. So it was published more than 20 years ago by Schachter and Bali that if this decay occurs, independent of what really happens in this box, one can connect this graph as so. And so you have an anti-neutrino coming in and a neutrino coming out. So those two species have to be the same. And so neutrino, let S double beta decay implies that the neutrinos are their own antiparticles. So why do people study the decay? Well, I just pretty much said it. If the decay is observed, there's something new that is not contained in the theory as proven so far. And so these are the kind of questions that double beta decay experiments try to answer. So are neutrinos their own antiparticles? And what is the absolute mass scale of these particles? And possibly other types of mechanisms that can cause this signature in a detector. That's kind of a second step. You have to couple it with other types of experiment to get some preliminary answers on this. So we know that neutrinos are massive from oscillations experiment, atmospheric, solar reactor, accelerator. And so we know that their mass or energy eigenstates are not the same as their weak eigenstate, which they produce in nuclear reactions. And the two states are connected by a matrix, as shown here. And so neutrinos mix, their mass states mix to form the weak eigenstates in which they're produced. So from all the experiments done so far, from the 60s onwards, I would say, we now know that neutrinos, the three light species that we know about, are separated by two mass splits. One determined in the solar and Hamlin experiments, where the delta M squared is a difference of the squares of the masses of the two energy states, 1 and 2, is 8·10⁻¹⁵ eV squared, and the mixing angle for that for those two states is tan squared theta around 0.4. And there's another split, which is bigger, is about 3·10⁻³ eV squared, and the mixing is maximal or close to maximum. For completeness, I'll mention that LSMD has seen another signal which would imply a delta M squared of about an eV squared and small mixing. And Boone at Fermilab is probably about to give an answer on this, or hopefully to give an answer on this. If this were to be the case, then one would have to imply other types of mixings. You can't include all these three with just three states. But I won't spend much time on this in this talk. So the summary on neutrino mass is depicted in this sketch. From the oscillation experiments, we know the differences in mass of the various mass eigenstates of neutrinos. But we don't know where this mass scale sits. So of course, there's two possible scenarios. One is where the differences in the mass states is very small compared to the mass scale. And the other one is where the delta M squared is very close to zero or starts at no mass. Within these two possible scenarios, we know that M2 is bigger than M1 from solar experiments, but we don't know if M3 is bigger or smaller than M1 and M2. And so this is where we stand. Now, of course, other people have done other things. Neutrino experiments with beta decay of tritium set the mass scale at
smaller than about 2 eV. Cosmology is telling us that the sum of the masses is around 1 eV. Double beta decay experiments that, on the other hand, require neutrinos to be their own anti-particles set today a limit, I say 0.3 eV or so. There's a squiggle there. It depends on a few factors I'll talk about in a minute. This is just to break the talk. Neutrinos are also useful. They save lives. I don't know if any one of you rock climbs. This is a neutrino. Back to business. So, double beta decay. In double beta decay experiments, what one is trying to measure is conceptually very simple. It's just counting the events that happen in a certain amount of mass, of target, of isotope, of interest, in a certain amount of time. So this is what we measure, assuming that you can subtract all the backgrounds. And this is how you translate it to neutrino mass. So it's 1 over the square root of half-life. There's a phase space factor that we can compute. And there's a matrix element, which one can compute, calculate, estimate, approximate in a number of ways. This factor is first order of order 1. And so the mass effective term that you measure in this kind of experiment takes into account that the states mix. And I want to stress here that this is a sum that can't cancel itself. This is different in the tritium experiments for beta decay, where by looking at the deformation of the energy spectrum of the electron in beta decay, one can imply a mass term which is a sum of positives.
So it's always above.
So we actually know where we know this from oscillation experiments cannot be below the minimum split,
the maximum split of the mass states.
Putting in a graph here, I'm plotting that m beta beta term I've shown before against the minimum state, the sum of the states, and the mass term that you derive from the tritium experiment. And you can see that in double beta decay experiments, you can be unlucky and you can just go down and down and down to vanishing. So today, with the experiments that have run today or are about to run, we sit about up here. EXO, the ton scale experiment I'll discuss in a minute, and other competitors are aiming at sensitivities down here, which means mass states of tens of millielectron volts. Right now, it's hundreds of millielectron volts that we're.
The hatch region represent allowed regions where both experiments have to be consistent.
Yes, that's right. So you put experiments together, and this is where you sit. So if you measure one thing on one experiment, you measure the other in the other experiment. Now the errors are pretty big. Even the separation here is going to be very tricky to make sure that you really rule out or discover something very, very specific. But people are trying hard. And the time scale for these experiments is about 10 years from now. It's not tomorrow.
What are those numbers, 10 to the 2018?
It's lifetimes for the double beta decay. So you need a sensitivity of this kind to be able to infer a mass term down there. And it depends on that m squared, depending on the isotope you use. But they're fairly similar. Actually, I think I have a typo here. I think there's one that's 3 here. But anyway, it's they're very close.
No, those chosen because the only ones that that have the correct lifetime don't have the required decay. Or are those the only ones that people are considering? Are there others? Or?
Well, here for simplicity, I only put these 3. There's people who I think of using selenium-82. Neodymium-150, there's another, tellurium-130, as Quadite does, which is not here. But it would fall in that time. This is the neutrino. This is the interesting one. With just the two electrons emitted, the non-standard channel. For many isotopes, the two new channel has already been seen and measured, and it's order 10 to the 20, 19 to 21, really, but depending on the isotope. And xenon actually is missing there. There's an experimental limit at 10 to the 22, which not everybody really believes completely, but anyway, it's very long compared to other isotopes, and this is good for the background tail that we will have. So these are the candidates that people are studying, and xenon is down here. This is the endpoint energy. These are the ones I show are the ones that have a Q energy, which is high, above 2 MeV, and this is mainly an experimental issue. You want to be above the backgrounds that typically occur in materials. Now, there are some which are above there, so they're not completely free of background. But if you go below there, you're completely swamped. You cannot build anything, essentially, that's clean enough. People are starting to explore the idea of double capture and other types of decays with coincidence de-excitations and things like that. I really won't talk about this here, but there are some ideas out there for other ways to study the same thing, basically. And these are the limits on the neutrino double wave decay for the various isotopes. I hope they're all up to date. A few might be slightly old, but there's actually a claim of discovering the decay, which very few people trust. It has opened a lot of debate. I think until somebody else goes and probes that area of the parameter space, I think it's still an open question.
Can you tell us when the result came out and what experiment that is?
It's an experiment at Gran Sasso. It's Claptor's group. It came out, I think they first published something in 2001. Here, the quote here is from a subsequent paper where they reanalyzed their data. I wish I could show actually the plot that they published. Anyway, it is published in there. And it's mainly a matter of interpretation of fits to a Gaussian. Not only that, I mean, it's a matter of choosing the energy range in which you declare that you want to do a fit. It also depends on how strict you are in forcing the fitter to find all the known peaks.
Does everybody use 90% confidence level?
That's pretty standard, yes. Except this is published at 96. That's a standard way of quoting results. Of course, you can make it more stringent, and it's going to go down. I think as long as everyone does the same thing,
it's
fair. So the exo strategy is to eventually build a ton scale. We talk about 1 to 10 tons, depending on funding and what the status of the field is at the time. Xenon 136 double decay experiment, where we collect the ionization and the scintillation produced in the detector. And then for interesting events at the energy we are interested in, we go and look for the barium ion. You might see here that the ion is only a barium plus, not plus plus. This is because energetically the ionization energy of xenon is lower than that of barium plus plus. So it will immediately capture an electron. Now, there's still an open question on whether this is going to actually survive as an ion for how long, and I'll say a little more about that in future slides. And the approach that collaboration has taken is to build a prototype with no tagging to study a detector of this size, which is already a challenging endeavor. So it's a fifth of a ton of xenon enriched at 80% in the ISO 136. In parallel, three groups in the collaboration are studying the barium tagging. I'll talk about the Stanford effort. And then eventually, in a couple of years from now, to merge into a proposal for the time scale, a full EGSO experiment.
In what sense is that barium identification unique, or you could explain?
Yeah, I will explain it. I'll first talk about EGSO 200, and then I'll follow that list of items. So EGSO 200 is a liquid xenon 200 kilogram detector, 80% enriched in xenon 136. It's laid out as a double TPC, as I'll show in sketches and drawings, with a readout of the scintillation light as well, with a fairly large acceptance angle. And these are the goals. Well, go probe the region which is under debate for the claim of discovery of the non-standard double BDK interaction. It should do a measurement. It should see the standard channels, which has not been seen for this isotope. That will depend on nature. The limit so far is 10^22, and this is in years. Other experiments have limits which are a factor of 10 smaller, but they're all limits anyway. Everyone agrees that it's a limit. Theorists believe that it should be around here, though. So it really should be pretty close if theorists are right. And then, of course, this is going to act as a prototype for the big EGSO in terms of technology. We have proven the enrichment on a large scale. We actually have the isotope at hand at Stanford. And then we'll test all sorts of TPC component, and especially the light sensors. We are immersing avalanche photodiodes in the detector. They're cold. It's never been done with such a large amount of devices. And then we'll test the purity of the xenon and other things.
Why is that only two neutrino?
Two neutrino lifetime limit is still a limit. It has not been seen. It's the only isotope of the list I've shown that has not been seen already in the standard decay. Yes?
Kind of off the subject, but where do you get that much xenon?
It was enriched in Russia.
It was
tried to do, there was an attempt to do it in the United States, which failed. But the United States funded its non-proliferation funds that were used to use
the reactor source?
No, the xenon itself is just procured from Mer Liquide or Linde or a gas company. And then you send the bottles to Russia and they separate it.
Oh,
right. And they send you back the enriched stuff, and then you restock the depleted part with the company. That's actually a cost. To restock the surplus is actually a cost in the game. Anyway, so the two neutrino double decay event rate according to experiments in red and theory in blue. As I said a minute ago, we should be really close to that, unless the theory is very wrong. And if that's the case, EGSO 200 will see about 70 decays per day in the fiducial detector. That's a high rate experiment in this business. Of course, there's other sources of background, and there's going to be a spectral shape to fit, which if you have a lot of gamma peaks, is distorted and things like that. But it should be a done deal if the numbers are right, if theorists are right.
So what is the dominant decay mode of xenon?
Xenon 136 is considered stable.
Oh, okay.
If
so
you look on the table of isotopes, it's considered stable. Because of if the lifetime is billions of times the life of of the cosmos,
so
of the universe,
okay.
Is considered stable.
Yeah.
And that's why you need a lot of mass to just see a few decays. This, in a nutshell, is the concept. You have an ionizing event in xenon. This separates electrons and ions. You drift the electrons and collect, and you have a blip. Some of the electrons recombine, forming dimers of xenon, which then emit light to which the medium is transparent, because this is the excitation of a dimer, not of the atom itself. And you can collect the light. And from the position in X and Y of the electrons, you have two coordinates. When you see a flash, that's you start the clock. And then you have a drift time, and you have a TPC reconstruction.
You called this a double TPC?
I'll show it in a minute. It's just two symmetric TPCs, one next to each other. I'll show a sketch in a minute. Here, I just want to stress the importance of measuring both the electrons and the scintillation light to squeeze those sigmas, as I said a minute ago. With just the electrons or just the light, it's really hard in this kind of detector to have very sharp peaks. It was proven prior to my arrival to Stanford that combining the two readouts, one can take a projection on some other axis and actually improve the resolution.
What are those three things?
Oh, this is a bismuth 207 source. This is background tail. This is 570 kV,
okay.
And this is a 1060 kV. Gamma ray. Comparing to the readout of just the electrons to the combined one, this graph shows how you can actually push down the width of those peaks by a significant amount. The power by which it depends is almost the sixth power. So even a small change here is very important. And so the ionization and scintillation alone scale as per root of 1 over square root of E to the endpoint of xenon 136 from lab experiments is giving us 1.4% at the endpoint. And this is basically what we base EXO-200 on. We actually say 1.6 just to be a little cautious. And some of the thinking for the big EXO. EXO-200, incidentally, will have much more light collection than this small setup in the lab. So it is possible that it might actually be better if things work.
These ones are about 2, but I thought Aprilia, they also use scintillation light.
Yes. Well, they don't do the microscopic anticorrelation of each event. So you statistically collect the two, and you have the two spectra statistically separated. But then you don't correlate each single event in that diagonal island.
Okay.
It's slightly different.
Okay.
So if you change the drift field, then you change the amounts of electrons and light that you collect, and you see these effects in one dimension, if you collect only the light or only the electrons. What was done new here is to do them at the same time and see that tilt as a correlated or anti-correlated signal. Yes?
So when you talked in the beginning about identifying the signal that you that's the scintillation light?
No, the ion still has not come in the picture. Right now, I should stress it better, I guess. EXO-200 has no bearing tagging at all.
Oh.
It's just the xenon TPC technology. Whereas the barium identification so far is happening in the lab as R&D. It's still not finalized. It's not complete yet. And I'll say this. And I'll show where we stand later on.
I don't understand the source of the
scintillation light occurs in xenon and argon, actually, and neon and helium, when electrons and ions, some of them recombine prior to being separated by the drift field. And by recombining, they make excited atoms, and some excited atoms combine in dimers.
In a molecule of two atoms, which is excited though, and the de-excitation of the dimer emits light, which is scintillation in xenon, in this case. That's the mechanism by which it happens. And this is important in these detectors because it allows you to separate beta events and nuclear events, because the density of electrons around the interaction point is different. Hence, the ratio of light to charge is a function of type of interaction that you have inside the detector because of the mechanism of production of light.
So the electrons didn't capture by not the decay product, just some other.
Well, there's many electrons around. So a lot of them just recombine with the ions from which they've just been separated. A non-ionizing event ionizes
the
xenon.
So these are the tracks.
These are the tracks, essentially.
From your electron. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
So, one more, let you get past the slide. This plot is at what energy? Just trying to compare apples to apples. This can't be enough?
All these are the 570 peak.
They're all at
yes.
All right, so it is...
Yes. And then everyone scales at the endpoint, at whatever energy, at 1 MeV or whatever you want. So the exotpc, I'll go quickly here. I actually should probably go to a sketch of it. And this is what I mean by a symmetric TPC. There's a cathode in the middle. Events happen on either side, and then they drift towards either plane, depending on where they happen. Then we have light diodes on the two ends of the cylinder for the scintillation light collection.
What are the dimensions?
The dimension, this is about 16 centimeters from the cathode to the plane, and this again is about 20 centimeters. It's 14 diameter about. So it's almost a square cylinder.
The 1 ton is going to be how big?
Sorry?
The 1 ton is going to be how much?
Well, the density of xenon is 3. So 200 kilograms are in something that's like 20 in it's 40 diameter and 40 in length, about. And you can scale. It's not very big. I mean, it's density 3, a ton is not very big. Depending what kind of axis you'll need for the tagging. That's a technological issue. Yes.
You could tell me that you're going to go through this at the end, but I'm just a little lost. You said that right now you have a prototype at Stanford.
Rebuilding, yes.
That's with Grotta?
Yes.
And is that on campus?
It's on campus.
And then that will lead to a proposal or some mergence of different prototypes that will lead to a proposal?
No, there's only one xenon prototype.
Okay, so what I'm saying is 200 is the step after the prototype.
200 is the prototype.
Is the prototype. Okay, so 200 leads to 1 ton, but then you have to merge. This is just the Stanford effort, is that right?
No, this is a collaboration effort. There's a few ideas on how to do the tagging in the collaboration. Everyone is behind the prototype, in quotes. It's actually a big experiment.
So in the prototype is going to run somewhere.
It's going to run at WIP, and we're planning on shipping it starting in May.
WIP is?
It's a nuclear dump site in New Mexico.
Okay. And
a salt mine.
The 1 ton version is the one that you're looking at Dussel?
Possibly.
There's
no real proposal yet, and there's no technical proposal yet for that. It's going to be who knows where. One of the roles of the prototype, for example, is to evaluate if this kind of experiment, a place such as WIP, is deep enough.
Okay.
Or if you have certain types of backgrounds which you want to further push down, even for this kind of experiment, which is sort of high energy compared to WIMP experiments, for example, which are very sensitive to how deep you are, even more than we are.
And who all is on the collaboration besides Stanford?
That collaboration is Stanford and Slack. There's actually two groups.
Right.
And
Prescott, right?
Prescott and, yes.
Okay.
And then there is, in the United States, there is Alabama and Maryland, just new, Carter Hall.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then Canada, there's Carlton and Laurentian. And it's Neuchâtel in Switzerland has a sizable group. And ITEP in Moscow. I think I got them all.
And they're all on EXO, but then how many of these different neutrinos, double beta decay experiments are running around?
There's about
five
or six, I think.
Okay.
I mean, there's Cuoricino, there's Gerda, Majorana, which you can count as one or two. Nemo, Super Nemo, Moon. That's about it. That are planning something on this scale.
Okay.
There's a few others are now still thinking of much smaller things so far. So this is a view of what the detector is going to look like. The TPC is going to sit in a barrel. The barrel is made of very thin copper, selected for low background and stored on the ground. Everything is housed inside a cryostat. It's double-walled and vacuum-insulated, again, of super thin copper. There's going to be a bath, a cryo fluid by 3M. It's a fluorinated fluid by 3M. Which turned out to be incredibly clean. So it's going to provide shielding from everything from the cryostat outwards. I underline that the copper of the barrel here is very, very thin. So that's actually quite an achievement to make. The cryostat, in turn, is shielded by low activity lead, but it's not agent lead. It's just selected for low contamination, and everything is inside a clean room currently at Stanford. This is a Stanford installation. These are the clean rooms. The detector sits down here. Clean room is bigger. It houses all the xenon plumbing and the electronics, the refrigerators, and
is
some.
Is that Heppel?
This is Heppel in station 3, yes. There is components outside of the clean rooms. For example, the cryofluid is stored in this container that there's plumbing that now is actually installed that goes inside the clean room into the detector. Heppel in station 3 is very nice because it's surrounded by 6 feet of concrete all around. And so it's excellent to store the copper to avoid activation of biceps inside the copper. This is a full length engineering view of the TPC inside the copper can. We build the TPC, we make it. It's made out of very low activity support acrylic parts from actually Snow collaborators. There's some reflectors for the scintillation light made out of very clean Teflon. There's cables coming through the legs and connecting to the two ends where there's the wires, XY, and the APDs for the light. And once the TPC is in there, we put the end caps in and we do a final weld in place in the clean room. This is the plan. This is just another view of how complex the thing is from one end. These are the cables, the traces that connect connectors to actually other strip cables with screws. Every single piece is screened for contamination. Every screw, every bolt. This is the wire technology that we use. These are photo etched from a sheet of bronze that was identified as particularly clean. And then you photo etch these shapes, then you bend the end into a little springy thing, and it just hooks up, and it's very sturdy. You can hit it with a book, and it doesn't break. The APDs are read out in groups of 7 to minimize the number of channels and optimize cost of this EXO-200 prototype, in quotes. These are other views of the copper can and all the effort that's gone into thinning it down with all the FEAs which are needed. This is just a mock-up to play around and have an idea of how big the detector is. This is a person. This is essentially a half of a detector. Of the copper container, although it's made of acrylic.
Should be so thin.
radioactivity, because although it's ultra pure, it's not as pure as xenon or the HFE fluid, and so you want to minimize it. And there's always the chance that it activates during the shipment to WIP, for example. It goes to almost a mile high for a day and then down in the mine.
Your main background, you just worried about gammas, right?
The main background is gammas, although I might have, in private, we can talk about a lot of other backgrounds that we are concerned about. These are pieces that are made out of our ultra-pure copper. We actually have all the machine, the mill, and the lathe down in the pit, so it's screened somewhat by two cosmic rays. The APDs that come in batches of tens to 100, are each individually tested cold. So we have a setup that's cooled with a copper plate. You cool the plate. You have an X-ray source and a scintillation source. You put it inside a vacuum, and you test each APD. This is a big job. And it actually turned out to be an excellent setup to test the readout. We found all sorts of bugs in the readout that are now fixed. This is a kind of signal that we look for. An X-ray pulse in the APD is like this. Scintillation is like this. This is from one APD alone. And the scintillation is an alpha source in a xenon in two atmospheres, so it creates a little flash of scintillation one can read. Other views of what the detector will look like, this is the lead wall. These are the connection of the xenon condenser into the detector. Purity screening, like the one that is running up at Slack in the lab, to continuously screen the purity of the xenon that goes in and out. I don't have much time to really go into explaining all this. This is a picture taken when we did the first cryogenic test of the cryostat. It was empty. We just closed it and tested the refrigerator and the cryostat. I forgot to mention that the detector is cooled by fridges. There's three of them. There's heat exchangers inside the cryostat, and there's some type of freon that is acting as a coolant. Some details. These are features for the thermocouples, which is epoxied, and it's leak tight actually. It was an interesting achievement. Except for where the freon goes in, away from it, the detector is very smooth in terms of temperature. This can only improve when the fluid is in there and the mass is much bigger, and when we have super insulation also on the front face, which we didn't have in this test. This is how it looks like inside the clean room. Now, we took those connections apart to fix a few leaks, and in order to install all this other HFE plumbing, which is now all being leak tested and commissioned. This is the one that's up in that container outside I've shown. This is the xenon pump plumbing in here. A getter is going to be installed here. It's not in yet. It's a CS, a pretty standard type of getter in the field. This is the condenser can. This is the purity can, inside of which there's a monitor. This I just took a picture because it's the radon emanation chamber that we connect to all the plumbing to assess the emanation of radon from all the plumbing wells, joints, etc. That is a background, and it's a background because of the gamma ray. Well, I'll show it in a minute. This is the stockpile. Not particularly impressive. It's a set of 10 bottles. And this is the mass spec scan of the enrichment. They all came with nice documents and scans and all that. We performed a very aggressive campaign of finding the materials clean enough for the detector. Metals, plastics, epoxies, APDs, lead, copper. And so the ultimate goal is that we have some sort of measurement of every single screw that goes in the detector. And maybe that will give some handle on when we turn on and see the backgrounds. Of course, we can't test everything, and when you have a set of screws, you test one or two, the others might be contaminated, or one might be contaminated, and you don't know. So the gammas we're concerned about, the main one is this one. Because the endpoint is 2459. It's actually a recent
change. It used to be 79 there with a big error. The error now is shrunk to a few kV, and it's 24 faithfully. So there's no way that we can separate that line out, even if even at 1%, even at 0.8%.
What's your signal gamma?
Pardon? It's a 2.449 kV, which is a daughter of radon.
The Q for you, the signal.
Oh, the signal is 2459.6
okay.
or something
okay.
like that.
Okay.
So it's 10 kV away.
Yeah.
And it's dead on. So this is the main one. Then, of course, there's the gamma and the thorium decay chain. The potassium is a concern for the two neutrino channel only. Cobalt-60 is a concern. When these two add up, they're very close to the Q value. And other lines, which I don't
this is because
specify.
You can't separate the fact that
No. We can, but the rejection is not one.
Okay.
For example, for the cobalt, you separate almost all of them. But since you go and look for a few events a year, there's a chance that the two interact close enough that you see them as point event, as one event.
So that's the reject, that looks like background, but this gamma, what will it do? Double Compton scatter and look like...
Oh, if it does Compton scatter far away from each other, yes, you separate it, you throw it away. But
okay.
There's cases in which you have the two depositing exactly that amount of energy essentially at the same point. It's one out of a million, out of whatever, but it hits you. And since the cryostat is all copper, it's like 6 tons of copper, you can easily have 5 events a year that way, if you don't screen the copper appropriately. And 5 events a year is a background for us. I'll go through numbers in a minute of what kind of event rate to expect. Keep a database of all the materials we screen. This is not public yet, but we'll publish a named paper at some point. It's hundreds of entries. It's just amazing. Just to explain what kind of effort we went through, when we purchased a second batch of copper for our TPC chamber, colleagues at Daisy stacked this bunker for us to hold it there because it's made. It's close to them. The affinery is close to them, and the roller is also there. So it had to be stored for 2 months while we assessed the purity of the raw material. And they actually built the thing, and then we bought a container which is screened with concrete to ship the copper to us, and then the TPC is going to go to WIP in there. So it's a lot of effort, and eventually the detector is going to end up starting presumably May of 2007. It's a pretty firm date at WIP. This is our shaft. The muon flux is published in NIM, and it's almost 2 kilometers of water equivalent depth at which we'll sit. And these are the other numbers regarding the 200, fifth of a ton, efficiency of 70%. This includes fiducial cuts and other types of cuts. A running time of actively two years, so it might run for more than human 2 years, of course. Sigma 1.6, although maybe it could be better. And in those 2 years, we expect in the region of interest at the endpoint, 2 sigma away from the endpoint, 20 events a year. This is a number that is kind of our goal. So far, it's not like we already have all the materials and everything, and we say it's that. We say we can't go beyond that if we want to reach sensitivity in the region of interest for the claim that was made. And if this is satisfied, the lifetime that we can sample is set a limit on the order of 6, 10 to 25 years, which corresponds, according to models, to a mass of 180 to 500, and it's millielectron volts. So if everything goes well, it's competitive, and it should span the parameter space enough. Finally, barium identification. So xenon is specific in allowing, in principle at least, as Mo had suggested in 1991, to go and look with optical spectroscopy at the daughter And this is because barium plus has been studied extensively since the early 80s as a system. So if you have a laser at 650 and a laser at 93 nanometers, you basically can pump the state and have fluorescence in both channels be emitted. In a vacuum, if you do things accurate enough and well enough, you have a huge amount of light with one ion. And one ion, we have done it, and others have done it, can be stored in a vacuum for days. You put it in a trap that's well set up, you don't have a power failure or anything, it stays there for days.
You keep pumping the one ion up and down?
Yeah, you shine the light, the two lights on the ion. And this is because this state is very long. So if you only shine the blue, it will do this, and then fall there and stay there.
And then you do it again.
And so you have to repump it up with the red one. But this is standard. I learned it standard. I didn't know. I mean, it's good.
One ion.
One ion.
How do you get the daughter into the vacuum?
This is the tricky part, and I'll talk about this. So this is the idea.
I presume you don't have to keep it alive.
Well, how you do it is this. You have some sort of a grabber, you fish it out when you know where it is, and then you drop it in a trap. Now, this is all very easily said. There's two groups in the collaboration that work on detection in situ, shining the lasers in the detector. This is easier from one point of view. It's harder and less specific, because the lines tend to broaden, and broaden so much that then you don't know if it's a barium anymore, even. So, or you don't know if it's a barium 138 instead.
Broadening just dispersion in the.
Yeah, because when it's in the matrix of a liquid.
Blue shifts because the thing is moving around. I guess.
It's not just Doppler. No, it's not Doppler. It's just because it's like in a solid. I mean, it's basically the band structure changes completely. I call it a band structure. It's not appropriate probably for this field, but
how long until it captures an electron?
Well, this is one of the unknowns. We have done studies of mobility of ions in xenon, and it highly depends on the purity of xenon. If xenon is extremely pure, it can live for a long time as an ion.
Long time
minutes. Well, if you have an E field, it will drift. So eventually, it will hit the cathode. So depending on how big your tank is, and where the decay is, how close to it is. The problem I see is purity. If you have oxygen, water, CO2, then those are traps essentially for the ion. So I will only talk about the ideas of fishing the ion out, which is being done at Stanford and FLAC. So we need to identify the barium plus ion with high efficiency after having injected it into a trap. And xenon will be around the trap. You know, I said that a lot of these studies are done in vacuum. Well, we won't have a vacuum because we have some amounts of gas around. And so a theory of quadrupole traps, you have a quadrupole field, and you apply a DC potential. You stack many of these in a row, solve F equal MA, you have a trapping potential such as this. This is a trap that we have at Stanford. The ion will be trapped in this segment, which is very short, which is defining this very deep well. But the ion, if you don't cool it down, you'll push it in with some energy, go to the end of the trap and bounce back, or fly out. So you have a mechanism to cool it down. And this is helium. This is pictures of the trap that we built at Stanford. It's about that long. I think it's the longest in the world or close to that. Other people have used this kind of thing, and we got the idea from others. But these are close-ups of what the trap looks like. Everything is UHV assembled. This is a manifold for mixing the gases. We did studies of traces of xenon in the trap, if they tend to unload the ion or not. and tests of this kind, which I'll show in a minute. This is the vacuum chamber. These are the lasers that we use. And this is a picture of a single ion in our trap. These are the electrodes. This is scattered light off the electrodes. This, the picture is taken with a CCD camera, and this picture is taken with a buffer of 10 to the minus 3 torr of helium, which is a high pressure in this field. People tend to go in high vacuum to do this. And, you know, you can see the ion, but if you plot, if you load a bunch of ions, make a cloud of ions, and then you wait them to unload, you see this step profile as a function of time, where you can see 1, 2, 3, 4 ions very well. Then you
sorry, what sense can I see the ion in the picture? What am I looking for?
Here. Well, you integrate the light in the in a certain area compared to the light outside. And if you repeat the experiment many, many times, you always get this kind of profile, which is indicating that the light is quantized.
So
and it's telling you that an ion is added every time you see a step up in light. It's fluorescence light.
Is it like a filter where you're looking for a particular wavelength?
Not really. This is a CCD camera.
This is all
I mean, we have some filters, but it's not. It's nothing too fancy, really. It's more a matter of having things focused and aligned, and reducing the scatter of the beams off off the chamber of the vacuum chamber. This is a projection onto the y-axis of this thing, and you can see no ions, one ion, two ions, well, three ions has lived for a short time, four ions, etc. So this is well understood at this point. This is completely under control. It's about to be published. We did these studies in helium and argon. Argon tends to unload faster. Here I plot the unloading rate as a function of overall pressure inside the trap. And this is because argon is bigger, so collisions tend to be more unloading than for a helium background gas. And then we studied certain admixtures of a xenon amount in helium. And one can see that at some point, if there's too much of it, since the mass is the same as barium, a collision or two can unload. And so the lifetime inside the trap will be inverse of this y-axis is reduced. And so we will have to operate the trap controlling the amount of xenon that we inject while doing the transfer. And you can do this in a variety of ways, pumping appropriately, differentially pumping, having the trap big enough so that it dilutes, etc. There's many ideas on how to do the tip, the transfer tip, the hard part. To be honest, this is really the hardest part of all. I'll talk only about the cold tip, where you freeze the ion on xenon ice so that it doesn't touch any metal, so it stays an ion. And then you release, you sublimate the ice inside the trap. People at SLAC and on campus have worked or are starting to work.
Could you explain that first one a bit more? I mean, what do you think?
I will explain it. I will explain it.
He's fishing for one eye.
With pictures. So you have a little finger, mm-hmm. and you're able to freeze the tip of this finger, and I'll show how. And control the amount of ice you freeze on it. And so if you go where your event has been, or what you think you had an interesting event, and you think there should be an... You take the tip into the bath, and then you freeze a very thin amount of ice, and hopefully you capture the ion in it. And then you go into the trap, which is switched on, and you release it, and only the ion then is trapped. Because
first
it's
time,
the...
First time somebody said this, nobody laughed.
It is... I mean, we... You know, we don't know. I mean, we don't know that it's going to work.
Yeah.
But the previous graph you had said that the trap unloading. So it was an order of a minute that the ion survived in the trap, right?
In the trap, that's right.
So.
With certain amounts of xenon and helium, yes.
Exactly. So inside liquid xenon, it seems to me from reading those graphs, the ion's going to survive for less than a minute.
No. This is a matter of unloading from a trap. So you have a trap that is very small in size, and the ion can only be trapped here because of the electrostatics that that you apply. You have this well here. So if the ion collides with a xenon atom, it can go, the ion in here is orbiting around, is moving around. So it can just go to an orbit where it hits an electron, and that's gone.
So how?
Whereas in the bath, it's just a matter of floating around.
There's an electric field in the...
There's an electric field, but the mobility of the ions is very slow. There's a paper actually I can talk about. And the drift time of ions is very slow at the fields that we're interested in, kV per centimeter or so.
So the idea is you see the scintillation light somewhere in your...
You see the scintillation and the ionization.
Yeah.
You reconstruct the event.
And this barium is hardly moving.
Yes. You have to be able to fish it out within a minute or two.
Yeah.
You can't go after an hour and look for it. I mean, we have been thinking about other ideas, like having detectors at the cathode. So you wait for it to drift, and then you try to detect it. But then you have a problem of accumulation of barium, where you want to detect. And then are you detecting the one of that decay or the one from a week ago? Well, it won't stay an ion. That's true.
Okay,
And it's really hard to keep it an ion at an electron. So it's
high enough that you can have confusion whether a barium came from two different events.
Well, that's one of the backgrounds that you would have in that kind of scenario, because then you have all the bariums from the two neutrino events in the same kind of slice of detector. And when the detector gets big enough, you start hitting a background issue there. So, you know, we have gone through all these numbers, of course, and because of that and technical challenges with other approaches as well, at Stanford we're trying to converge on this. At some point you actually have to pick your fight, how you want to do it. You can't stay in parallel for too long, and you have to really put effort into it. So this is a first attempt that was done at SLAC of a Luke Thompson cool tip. This is ice frozen into a little cell. This had the problem, we were able with a source of thorium to trap ions and then count the decays of them and release them when you evaporate it. But this had a problem. This is a big hunk of ice that flops down. You have to control the cooling of all this. You can't just do it like that. So how you do this is you make something a little smarter. You do a system which you can control the temperature of at the tip very well. So you have a helium line now. Everything is way more complicated. You go to a temperature where the sublimation rate of Z of the ice is very low. Because otherwise, you're boiling off continuously, and if the ion is in there, it's gone. So you actually have to keep the original ice there. And a postdoc in our group came up with this idea of a capacitive sensor that is measuring the capacitance of the ice, hence the thickness. And by doing that, you can control the thickness of the ice that should freeze. This is how the setup looks. And these are all thicknesses of ice frozen from gas. He's doing it in liquid. He's playing around. This thing is changing every day. The picture is taken two days ago. I'm sure today it's different already. So this is really in progress. And the goal is to have such a setup on a system that we're actually starting to assemble now, which combines that setup where you fish into a bath and you will have some sort of barium source, we have one that sort of works, but it's still flaky. And then pull it out, put it in the trap, and release it. And then you can play, put the ion in. Once it's in the trap, we're able to move it around. If you want the ion instead of segment 14 and segment 6, you just change the parameters, whoop, and if you had the camera there and the light there, you would see it. Now, we can't do that because it's too complicated to have all these windows and extra lasers, but then you put it back at segment, at the original segment, and count back. So the trap at this point, I think, is a done deal. It's well understood. It's been running in many forms for years now in the group.
I think we understand it.
The needle, the stim has to penetrate the cryostat.
Well, how you do that, you either keep it in the vapor and then you immerse it, or the engineering of this is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Extremely difficult. And I think each one of us has a different idea of how one would do that. So, of course, the main challenges are you have to understand the efficiency of the overall transfer and whether the efficiency is because the ion doesn't stay an ion in the bath, or the ion doesn't stay an ion on the tip, or the ion flies out of the trap. This is a combination of efficiencies, and this has to be high. How high? Well, as high as we can. Of course, if it's too low, this is impractical. It won't work. And then we would use the two neutrino channel as a way to calibrate the experiment. You run it, you trigger on all the interesting experiments at the endpoint, and then after you know the lifetime of the two neutrino channel and you know the shape of that spectrum, you randomly trigger on some of those and make sure that you grab the ions appropriately.
Okay.
So during the lifetime of the detector, that's the way you go about making sure that it's working constantly and smoothly. So that's if you're able to do that, that's easy to calibrate.
Your efficiency for barium.
Pardon me?
That'll be to prove your efficiency
yes.
of barium collection.
And constancy in time,
so
too.
That depends on the cross section being where you think it is for the two new channel.
Depending the cross section.
Because that cross section is also an unknown right now, isn't it? It's just a limit.
Yeah, yeah. But EXO 200 is going to do a measurement, hopefully, of it.
And, you need
and the big EXO is going to have that piece of information at that point. If we don't, well, that's interesting in itself. Why is this so rare? It's probably an interesting issue in nuclear
okay.
structure, which I couldn't comment on. But it would be good for the background, but then it's hard to calibrate the detector. So it's somewhere in between it would be the ideal place to be. And so towards the ton-scale exo detector, we need, even after we do this grabbing and succeed, if we do, grabbing in a small cell, we will need to be able to grab from a big bath. It's not the same to just go in with a source and you know it's there, or to trigger an event and go look for it.
To detect it and then tell
them and so we'll probably put up a separate setup. EXO 200 is probably going to run for too long to use that, converting it to a grabber. I think we'll want EXO 200 to run for a long time to study all sorts of underground backgrounds, neutrons, and things like that. We need a low trigger rate, about 1 an hour. You don't want to fish in there too often. It disrupts the detector too much. And so it still has to be very low in contamination in whatever you put in there. Then you use the two neutrino channels for calibration. And the limiting factor at that point is the two neutrino channel itself, how much of that spillage you will have. And so you will want to improve, presumably, the collection of light to make it as 4 pi as possible. Yeah, I think that's the way to go. I think at this point it's understood. At all fields, you can sweep the detector with the highest field. You get an ultimate floor. And so I think the light is the trick there. The trick, I mean, it's not my trick, but it's well known at this point that I think the light is the issue. And then making a nice a source. It's very hard to make a source of barium ions in liquid. To have single ions or few ions deposited in liquid. If you shoot it from above, then you have the liquid to gas interface. Who knows what the ion physics is there? And and so, as my last slide with numbers, these are the sensitivities we're aiming for. So we always have these two lines. One is a one-ton detector that runs for 5 years with the the energy separation of EXO 200. Here it's 1.6 again. It oscillates between the 1.4 and 1.6. We need these lines. And then the aggressive one is a 10-ton detector for 10 years with 1%. And the limits you would get on the neutrino S double beta decay are about 10 to the 27, 10 to the 28 years lifetime. And that's in the couple of tenths of milli-EV mass range. So this is the goal. I conclude saying this is all very attractive. EXO 200 is well on the way. Will run soon. we'll first run with unenriched stockpile, was to study all sorts of background, and we actually have it already. We have the bottles. It's a big ticket item already. It's not cheap.
What is it, $1,000 a kilogram?
It's no. It the 200 kilogram, 210 cost about 100 something k.
Okay, well, extra two.
We actually had budgeted $1 a kilo, and then went for bids, and it turned out to be like 53 cents a kilo. After some massaging, we're like, we're really buying a lot. Oh, Linde is more interested than you guys are, or whatever.
You mean $530 a kilo?
Sorry?
$530 a kilo.
Oh, yes, sorry. Did I say that? A kilo or a gram?
Yeah, right. So that's 53.
Sorry, it's a dollar. I said a dollar a gram.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. So the barium identification scheme is well defined, at least at Stanford, although other groups are doing other things. There's some space for combining some of the expertise. I don't have time to go into this. For whoever is interested, I can answer offline. And if this is realized, then a ton scale exo is going to be proposed, presumably in the near future. And this is a collaboration with institutions, and hopefully some help from above. And that's it.
100% male.
Say that again?
100% male. These days, collaboration.
Yeah, we have two females now.
Did it? Okay.
Yeah, since the picture was taken.
Ah. Can't have that.
I know.
Okay.
So the xenon cold dark matter experiment has a lot of the same requirements as you. They also have a QPC also using liquid xenon. Is there any possibility for combining your experiments?
Well, you wouldn't want to use the enriched stuff because that's a background for them. Although, I mean,
why?
Because you have low event.
Well, but if you can
low energy events.
You can separate it with QPC or with scintillators.
Yeah, you can use the depleted one. You mean?
Is
that what you mean, or you can just separate it as beta event instead of nuclear event?
Yeah,
of course. I mean, if the rejection factor is good, you probably would not want to purposely add beta events, even if you know you can throw them out.
Are they removing the xenon 136 from there?
No.
So this is going to be background for them anyway.
Yeah, but it's a factor of 10 smaller.
Why?
If it's not enriched.
Because the enriched stuff is more abundant by a factor of 10 across. Anyway, that's not probably the driving thing, because in principle you could use the depleted part of the xenon, which is.
dual phase.
But the point is that they're dual phase. The actual approach is very different.
Is it dual phase bad for you?
I guess a big exo could be a dual phase in principle. Although I think the problem is different because I think resolution is not the main issue of xenon. I don't think. Or at least, that's my opinion in some sense.
It's always an issue, but
you don't want to resolve a peak. That's what I'm saying.
You don't need absolute.
Whereas we are resolving a peak, and that's part of the game. And I think the two phase makes
because,
it harder.
It's elastic scatters, so the amount of energy is a continuum. They have a line.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying it's impossible. I mean, presumably one could come up with
I think part of the reason is historical. These groups never talk to each other, really.
I think you're right.
That's the
perhaps
well,
these things
and schedule-wise,
when they start costing what they're proposing,
yeah.
$10 million, DOE will come hit everybody on the head, and they will start talking.
Maybe at the one time
they've gotten away.
Well,
when the enrichment occurred,
actually,
yeah.
It would have seemed to make sense to have a shared program. You get the depleted part. Which doesn't make a big, you know, it doesn't change very much for you guys, for the dark matter people. But you know, you can make it cheaper. You don't have the restocking fee and all that. But apparently, you have to have a huge chunk of funding coming to both experiments at the same time by different agencies. You're asking for the impossible.
Yeah,
I think politics is a lot in this. both politics of
scientists
and funding.
Do this, the cost of the hall, the cost of cryogenics, the cost of the canning facility, cost of storage facility, all those things don't need to be duplicated. So in the end, I can imagine these two experiments being together as in side by side. Everything else common. And that, I think,
it's
is
not
right
impossible.
Problem.
I mean, it's
because,
not impossible.
You know, you don't want to have duplicate everything, including your, you know. I mean, for example, for Lux type of detector, just the cost of, you know, pumping clean air into the room is enormous.
Oh, yeah.
Just to keep the humans alive and dirt free environment, and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't think DOE will duplicate. Or NSF, right? I think they would.
Well, this makes a lot of assumptions that DOE and NSF talk to each other in the first place.
They're talking. I think the DSAC report will have recommendations.
I mean, it's to be hoped to some extent. I think there's also another issue of how much of having a joint experiment drives the compromises you make.
That's
on
true.
The on how you do a measurement and how you build a detector. And I think a ton-scale detector for either, it's going to be so fine-tuned that then who decides which way to
you
tip?
You can be side-by-side. That's, I think, the best you can do.
And then transfer
work.
The same xenon. You
things
mean?
Like, you share the infrastructure, but the philosophies are different.
The two detectors will have to be separate in some sense. I mean, the WIM people will say, I don't want the tip going around the detector
because
and fishing ions. Right.
You have a doorless what's in the tip in terms of neutron background, right?
Well, that and disrupting the operator, whatever, you know. And at that point, who
that's
drives the schedule on how to operate the detector?
You try telling me freely that I'm going to poke a needle into your detector. Throw you out of the room.
And, you know, understandably so to some extent. You know, it's at some point, you go so far as to build such a detector you want. When you run it, you want it yours, and you want to run it the best you can, because it's going to have problems anyway. Already, I mean, without others adding problems to that, I don't know. It's infrastructure, yes. I mean, but this goes with it, you know, with we're setting up a facility that we call a lab, where we do this kind of experiments. That's essentially sharing infrastructure. And having a place where a certain type of problems are common to everyone, and you have a way to solve them. That alone, especially in the United States, doesn't seem to be an easy issue. Unfortunately, Snow Lab is taking off. I mean, but you know they're doing a wonderful job. I think they had a great experiment, and now they build off it. Gran Sasso, I won't comment on.
Instead of one paper per year, you publish two papers per year to combine.
Yeah.
That's a joke.
So.
One paper every other year.
But a lot of the problems are similar. Like all the radon backgrounds and neutron backgrounds. They're similar for different things.
Well, of course, krypton removal, all the radon.
Yeah, krypton, for example, for us is marginal because it's the lower energy spectrum. Part of the spectrum, although it will deform the two neutrino, but it's only low energy. And the neutrons are a problem for us in terms of capture and producing gamma ray de-excitations. For you, it's the actual collision.
Okay, well, I think we should thank you once again.